Hey guys, welcome to another fun episode of TFL Car Chat. And if you're watching this on YouTube, you'll see that no longer next to me is my son Tommy, but instead we've got Sam Abu El Salman. Did I say that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
good. Bless it.
I think I'm certainly old enough to be Tommy's father. you and I are closer in age than Tommy and I.
So Sam is a longstanding automotive expert. Is that fair? He's a mechanical engineer by training.
Self-proclaimed expert, yeah.
Yeah, and now you work for Telemetry Insights, yeah. Which is...
It's a small firm based in the Detroit area. I lead the market research efforts, focusing on all kinds of advanced automotive technologies.
And he's got a most excellent podcast called Wheel Bearings that I listen to every week. So if you're looking to add to your subscription of great podcasts, check out Wheel Bearings. Him, Nicole, and my friend Robbie have a lot of fun reviewing cars, talking about news and just kind of...
Sticky children.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff.
French cigarettes.
Pies, good pies.
Good pies.
Yeah.
what we're eating, you know.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
But today we're going to be talking about a pretty interesting topic that I think is both near and dear to your heart and my heart, and that is, why the heck aren't car companies listening to their customers?
Because they got into it, the problem is everybody wanted to be Tesla.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So you just pulled up in the Polestar 4, which we just had, and I came back from dropping my dog, picking up my dog from the groomer, and I pulled up next to the Polestar 4 in our long-term, we just leased Tesla Model Y. And they're both white, which mm-hmm. is interesting. And it's like everybody is copying Tesla, specifically Polestar, but they're not copying the right things. They're getting the idea, but the details are all wrong. So let's start with the obvious, which is, why is there no back window in the Polestar 4?
The back window, or the absence of back window, is absolutely something that I'm totally on board with on that car, because having driven cars like the Volvo C40 and a lot of other modern cars that have this fastback roofline, you can't see anything out the back anyway. Like the C40 has the same kind of fastback roofline. The window is about, I don't know, 6-8 inches tall. It's just this tiny little mail slot. And the same thing, it was the same thing in your Cybertruck.
Right, but that sounds like a focus group at Polestar, and I'll give you an example of where I think they got it right. So we have a long-term C8 Corvette, and you can't see out the back of that either. You mm-hmm. cannot see out the back, right? It's got the little, because what you're looking
at... That's typical of a mid-engine sports car like that.
Yeah, yeah. But what you're looking at is there's a little slot, and mm-hmm. then there's the engine, and then there is a clear view, but it's really tight. But what GM has cleverly done is they've given you the choice of either having a camera or looking out the back. So I love when car companies give you choice. In other words, you can pick one or the other. So if you don't want the camera, you can just flick the mirror to regular and you can look out the slit. And if you do want the camera, then you could, you know, do the camera. And I can tell you that me and Tommy always fight about this, because I like the camera, but he hates the camera. So we're always flicking it back and forth. But I think give people the choice. Don't just stick a blank piece of metal across the back. And by the way, I did ask Polestar if you could remove it, because you can see there.
Yeah, there's a bunch of electronics underneath.
There are
that
a bunch
panel.
Of electric. Yeah, yeah.
Because it does look like there should be a window there.
Yeah. And the excuse they give, because I went on the launch of this thing in Spain, is that it gives you more headroom in the back. And actually, mm-hmm. it does give you more headroom.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. Okay, hold on. I'm not sure if that's real or not. So what they may have done is they may have dropped the seat height. Right.
I think it's a combination of factors. But yeah, I mean, where the crossbar is for the roof at the back is further back than it would normally be.
True that.
Because they were able to do that because they said, okay, if we're not going to have a window here, we can put this bar, the structural bar, back a little bit further, and then just put the glass in there. So at your seating position, you are sitting under glass. So that does give you a couple inches of extra clearance there.
Yeah, and it does. Normally the problem with getting rid of the rear window is it would cut out the light coming into the back of the car, so it would make mm-hmm. it cave-like, but... With the glass roof, as you can see there, it does give you... Is that the Tesla or is it the Polestar?
No, that's the Polestar.
Yeah,
so it's very it is very airy in there. It doesn't feel claustrophobic.
But it just feels like some designer thought, hey, you know what? This car will be much cooler. This is a sense I get. I kind of feel like what has happened is Tesla has given designers the permission to be their worst.
Yeah.
Put style ahead of functionality.
Absolutely.
And we're seeing that in so many different ways. So like the one that obviously you and Nicole and Robbie harp on, and I've joined you in harping on, is the vent controls in the screen.
Yeah. To me, that is an absolute non-starter for any car that I get into. If I have to go to the touchscreen to adjust which direction the air is flowing, that's a fail right there. As much as I like the design of the Polestar 4 and I like driving it, things like that are just so irritating that I could not bring myself to actually buy it.
And I think what I figured out is that people fall into two categories, those who adjust their vents all the time and those who never adjust their vents.
Yeah.
Right? But what ends up happening is, once again, if you take away the little manual controls, you're taking away choice. Because if you don't adjust your vents all the time, then the vents in the screen are fine.
And in fact, you're actually making the system more complicated because now you've got to have motors and wiring
that
and actuators buried inside the dashboard to control where that airflow is going, rather than just having a little, you know, I mean, there is a cost associated with assembly of manual vents, you know, for all the parts, putting it all together. But those things never fail. You know, I've never had one of those things fail.
I have had an interesting failure, and it's not the vent. So we bought a cheap 911, 997.
Yeah.
And that has this neat trick where when you turn the air conditioner or heater on, all of a sudden...
A cheap German car is the easiest way to spend a lot of money.
Yes, because when I took it, and we just did this video over on Classics, when we took it to the local Porsche shop that does it, 18,000 repairs.
Yeah, I saw that the other day.
And it doesn't include this repair, which is it blows like little bits of some kind of degrading, like it's like a maybe sound insulation that comes out of the vent. So every time you turn it on, like these little bits of degrading foam come flying at you. And I'm like, what the heck? Did I just drive through, you know, some kind of a dust storm?
Yeah.
But I was going to tell you a story. So we went on the launch of the Nautilus, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I hated about the Nautilus was the same thing. It had those controls in the screen for the vents. And then we went to a cheeky dinner. It was like a steakhouse. Do you remember this place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was in California.
I ripped Kamal Kirk a new one for those vents.
Yeah.
And several other Lincoln people.
And so I had dinner with Kamal, who is the designer.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me what I thought of the car. And I said, I like the design. And then I was going to say, but one thing. And then he kind of started talking. And he said, I went to the mat on getting those screen controls. He said he really had to fight for them. And I was like, that's the hill you picked to die on? Really? That's the one? And I felt horrible because I had just made a good friend and we were really hitting it off. And then I'm like, oh, really? Is that the thing you wanted to?
Yeah. I mean, I've known Kamal a long time from when I worked at Ford. And, I like him a lot.
Oh, he's a great guy. Yeah.
But I totally 110% disagree with him on the vents. And especially the way that Lincoln implemented it. Because, you know, on the Nautilus and on the new Navigator, they have the full screen pillar-to-pillar display across the top of the dashboard, which is not a touchscreen, you know, and it's mounted up the base of the windshield. And then you have a touchscreen that is mounted at the bottom of the center stack, and it's almost vertical, and it's down low. And that's the one you use to adjust things like the vents. And you know the way where it's mounted and the way it's mounted, it's worse than if it was up high, because you actually have to look down low. Yeah, there it is on the screen. You have to look down away from the road, and then you're fiddling around. It's a couple of different swipes and things to adjust those vents. And it's just a dumb design.
Yeah, and I'm not loving that giant screen either. I think this car is built in China. And I think that the Chinese love big screens.
Yeah, these are very common now in China, these full-width displays. And also things like the touchscreen controlled vents. Apparently in China they don't adjust their vents. I don't know, I guess. And also the electromechanical door latches. But all of these things, interestingly, in China, all this stuff's going to be going away starting next year.
Yeah, that was also eye-opening when the Chinese government actually stepped in and said to the auto manufacturers, no more electrically, you know, controlled door handles. Because the problem with those, of course, is a guy died in a Tesla. Because
there have been multiple crashes where there have been fatalities because people could not get the door open after the power was lost, or either they couldn't get the door open from the inside, or people from the outside. You know, if the people inside were unconscious or injured, people from outside could not get into the car.
I think on the Model Y, the manual open is in front of the button, so it's easy to find. But
in the front doors,
in the rear doors, you have to lift up like a little. I think it's
in the cup, buried in the door pocket.
Yeah, and you have to
down
lift
low, You lift up a panel and then pull on a cable.
There's a little cable that you pull and open them. Yeah, it just seems like a recipe for danger.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the other one that I hated, which I believe you were talking about this, is the yoke.
Yeah.
So they're also outlawing the yoke because, and they're doing it in a really clever way, right? They're saying that they have to measure the circumference or the strength of the steering wheel.
And because at certain positions around the circle. And the yoke steering wheels don't have a top part. Those positions don't exist. Since they can't measure the strength of the steering wheel there, then that's by default illegal.
Yeah, and so they're going to do away with the yoke. And look, I think a lot of this started with Tesla. And certainly the big central screen started. Mm-hmm. Minis had central screen, right? But like the way that the industry adopted this was a little bit, I would say, poorly executed. So what I love about Tesla is, and let's talk about Tesla for a second. I kind of feel like a lot of automotive journalists are biased against Tesla. And I don't want to get into politics because then you're getting into this whole thing with Musk and we don't want to do that. But in general, Tesla doesn't give or lend cars to automotive journalists. Mm-hmm. And so I'm always amazed at like how many automotive journalists don't know what Tesla's up to or what good things they're doing. And then they inherently just go right to the bad stuff. And I'm not a Tesla fanboy. There are a lot of bad things that Tesla does. But there's a lot of good things. And I'll give you an example. So we just leased this Model Y, and this is our, I think, sixth Tesla that we've had. We started with the Model 3, and then we went to the Model X, and then we went to the Model Y, and then we went to the Cybertruck. I'm probably forgetting some. But
did you have a 3 Performance?
Yeah, we had a 3 Performance, and we had a Y dual motor as well, Performance. But like one of the things that they're doing is full self-driving supervised. And there's a lot of, especially in the automotive community, there's a lot of fear, and there's a lot of, and I heard on your podcast too, angst about, you know, how good is this and how safe is it? People are worried about the safety of it. And with the Cybertruck, this is just personal experience. It was good until, there was these until moments where, like, I remember I was driving it back from Golden and it almost took out a car. Uh-huh. It was good. But I haven't had those moments. And we've had now 4 of our staff. So Tommy drove it for a week, Case drove it for a week and didn't drive it for a week. Andre didn't drive it for a week and I didn't drive it for a week. And then Grant had it self-drive all the way to Utah. And it's gotten really good. And Sam, I maybe I'm being naive, but I sincerely believe that computers are better driving than humans. At least now they are.
I think I would say in most situations they are.
They don't get tired. They don't get drunk.
Yeah, and they certainly don't get drowsy. You know, on a late night long drive. There's a lot of scenarios where they are arguably better than human drivers. But, there's the problem with the software is it still is not that great at adapting to novel situations.
Yeah, Musk said himself, there's that like last, maybe it's 0.1% or maybe it's 0.01%.
Yeah.
But it's that last little bit that's the hard part.
But the problem is those are the areas where, you know, where anybody will have crashes. Because, you know, when you look at the data, you know, the number you tend to hear the most is, you know, human error causes 94% of crashes. Mm. And that's only partially true. Human error is a factor, usually the last factor in a chain of events in 94% of crashes. And actually, the reality is the number is probably a little bit less than that. But at any rate, what that doesn't tell you, though, is the actual frequency of crashes. The actual frequency of crashes works out to somewhere about one crash every 300,000 miles or so.
Yep.
Police reported crashes, about every 500,000 miles, which for an average driver that drives 15,000 miles a year, that's about once every 30 years that you crash. So that's an extremely low frequency.
Yeah, humans are really good at driving.
Yeah.
We're really good at driving.
Yeah, we don't get enough credit for how good we are at this incredibly complex task.
No, no, we're really good at it.
That is, you know,
but we don't have eyes behind our head.
Right. No, and that's absolutely true. Having that extra situational awareness from the other sensors.
So let's talk about an example of that, because I understand where you're coming from. So I was listening to Spike's Car Radio. Do you listen to that podcast ever?
Sometimes.
Anyway, they were talking about this incident. This has happened like 2 weeks ago where there was... it was a Waymo and it was driving and there was a school zone and there was a double parked car and this girl came running out and the Waymo slowed down. I think the Waymo was doing like 16 miles an hour and slowed down to like six or something. Yeah. I'm getting those numbers. And hit the girl. The girl, thankfully, was fine. Mm-hmm. She was okay. But everybody was kind of freaking out about the fact that the self-driving. And I brought up Spike's car radio because they have an attorney, personal injury attorney, on the podcast. And he was saying that if that went before a jury, he could just tear Waymo a new one. Because he was saying a human would know that this was a school zone, so they would. And then Waymo made this case that the car slowed down as quickly as possible in the amount of time.
Yeah,
and that
the car almost certainly responded a lot faster than a human would have when a human saw that kid running out.
Yeah, and they said the car and the human would see the kid at the same time, basically.
Yeah.
And then he said things like, well, a human would know that it's a school zone, that there are these things. And this is true, that there are kids that may run out, so a human might be more attentive or more able to actually perceive what the potential dangers of the situation are. But, dude, I used to take my son, Tommy, to school, and at the same time, a lot of humans were running late to work, a lot of humans were texting, a lot of humans were drinking coffee. So a human may have not been going the speed limit. A human may have been distracted, and it goes both ways.
Yeah.
And that's the part they failed to mention.
Mm-hmm. And, I've been driving around Denver for the last couple of days
in the
Polestar, and certainly around in the central portion of Denver. There's a lot. There's a lot of streets. A lot of the streets are in a grid pattern, but there's also a lot of streets running at odd angles, and there's a lot of narrow streets that are two-way streets, where it's street parking. People don't have driveways, so you've got cars parked all the way down both sides of the streets, and there's barely enough room for two cars to pass each other between those on a two-way street. And I think I know Waymo has been testing in Denver. I'm not sure where exactly in Denver they've been testing. I haven't seen any.
I have a guy. The time he just went to pick up. Yeah. It's funny. He just went to pick up our Fiat that we had at the shop. And across the street is a Waymo depot.
Yeah.
And they've got the new Chinese cars that they're testing.
Oh, the Zeekers?
Yeah, the Zeekers. Yeah. Instead of, obviously, the Zeekers don't have that issue where you have to have humans close the door.
Right. Yeah. This is something I've talked about for years. Is that they need to scale, they're going to need to move past upfitting conventional cars and actually have something that's purpose built.
The question I have, first of all, let me explain that. So if you want to install or stop a Waymo and you're using one, just don't close the door because the thing can't go if the door is open. And then you have to have a human come and actually close the door. But the Zeekr doesn't have that problem because it's got self-closing doors. But how come Waymo is allowed to import Zeekrs, which are Chinese-built cars, and yet there's 100% tariff on anybody else who's trying to do it?
They're paying 100% tariff on those.
Oh, so
I've talked to Waymo. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, really?
So, anybody can import Chinese cars. They just have to pay that 100% tariff.
So they're,
but it works out that even with the 100% tariff on that car, because it's designed to be a lower-cost vehicle than like the Jaguars they've been using,
it's kind of a minivan.
Yeah, it's a small minivan. It's like similar in size to a Ford Transit Connect.
Yeah, yeah.
And so even with the tariffs on that car, they've reduced the cost of their Waymo driver system, their sensors and compute so much that it's actually significantly less expensive than the current Jaguar I-Paces that they're using. So
they couldn't pick a more expensive car.
But they're also going to be launching Hyundai Ioniq 5s into their fleet this year as well. That are built in Georgia.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. Forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
And I also think that this is what's interesting. I also think that a lot of people don't trust full self-driving supervised because obviously Tesla has gotten rid of a lot of the redundancy. So they've gone to a purely camera-based
all
system.
All the redundancy.
Yeah, all the redundancy. I agree. But I was listening to an interview with the BYD chief technical officer, CTO, and initially he said that they wanted redundancy in their system. So they had, I don't know if they had LiDAR, but they had, you know, they had...
And they do still have cars that have LiDAR, and they've got ultrasonics and radar.
Yeah, but then he came back, and he kind of actually did a 180, and he said, a better system is just a camera-based system. So maybe Tesla was ahead of their time. I don't trust Tesla, per se, because I feel like, you know, they're very good at cost-cutting, and that's... So the truth, what's the truth? Is the truth that a camera-based system actually is better than something with different sorts of sensors and redundancies? Because of the way the computer can process the information. And we've seen that like with the Volvo, with the EX90, right, where it had LiDAR and they never got it to work, basically.
Well, there was other issues beyond – there wasn't so much of the LiDAR.
I mean, the CPU didn't work with the LiDAR.
Well –
Okay,
their base software platform was having a lot of issues. So they were having a lot of problems with their entire software architecture. So it wasn't just the LiDAR software. There was a lot of things that weren't working. And then when the sales of that car were much slower than expected, and Luminar was having all kinds of problems. That was their LiDAR supplier. Yeah. They basically decided to pull the plug on that and decided, need to focus our efforts elsewhere.
Now, what's in that binnacle now? Nothing? They kept the binnacle, the little...
No, that's going away. Okay. So the ones that have been built already, you know, they built, you know, some thousands of them with LiDAR sensors on them. But going forward, that'll just go away.
Okay, so there won't be like a little binnacle up there that'll have no LiDAR in it.
Yeah, there's no pod.
They'll get rid of it's a little pod on top.
Yeah.
All right. So let's go back to the topic. We were saying, why aren't automakers listening to their customers? So the thing, I think the magic in Tesla, and I'm starting like a Tesla fanboy, but there's so much that Tesla does that incorporates so easily into my life. I'll give you a good example of that. And this has been going on since the very first Tesla, phone as a key. Why can't anybody else get phone as a key right? With Tesla, it used to be also sometimes with the early Teslas that, you know, you would walk up to the car and it wouldn't open. And then you had to like go to your phone, open the app, and then it would open. But for the most part, you know, if you're using your Tesla every day, you just walk up to it, it unlocks, it locks. My wife has a BMW iX. Mm-hmm. Her phone as a key works like half the time. She has to have the actual real key in her pocket. And this is not just BMW, it's all the other manufacturers. Something so like, I'm not saying it's simple, but something that makes your life so much easier, you don't have to walk around with a second set of keys. It's just so nice where you just walk up to the car and you get in. And the other thing that Tesla does right is they got rid of the start-stop button. Why do you need the start-stop button, right? What's the rationale for that? Why don't I just get in the car, put in gear, and drive away? And then you park it, close the door, walk away, it locks, done. This is so simple. With all the other cars I have to fuss with the key. You know, I have to pull it out. I have to either use a proximity sensor or I have to use a door handle. This just seems like this is the way it should be.
Yeah, and you know, I have been very critical of a bunch of things that Tesla's done, but I also give them a lot of credit, you know, both for really legitimizing the idea of the EV, you know, saying that hey, this is really something that can be practical for really for most people, for most drivers, you know, even if they don't realize it yet, it's you know, for most drivers, an EV is a perfectly good solution. And, you know, so they've done that. They've also, you know, they were the first, you know, they pioneered the idea of the software-defined vehicle. And because they were starting from scratch, they didn't have an existing legacy platform to build up from. So they were able to build up both the hardware, the electronic architecture of their vehicle, and their software architecture hand in hand from the beginning, and you know they've had some issues, but for the most part they've done it really well. And you know they brought in, you know, they hired people coming from the tech industry that were familiar with the modern ways of software development, which is something we didn't have in the auto industry. I mean, the auto industry has been doing software since the 1970s. It's not like the legacy automakers didn't know how to do software, but they were doing different kind of software in a very different way that wasn't designed to be updated. And you know the pieces of software in the car were not designed to work together on a common platform. And so that's what the rest of the industry has been struggling with, is how to do it the way Tesla does. In China, you know, what we've seen in China is you've got this, dozens, hundreds of new automotive brands that have sprung up in the last 8-9 years that were basically did the same thing as Tesla. They started from scratch without a legacy platform, and they built it up the same way. And so this is what the rest of the industry is having to deal with. And so this is why, for example, now you're seeing with the Ford Skunkworks program, the Universal EV program, they struggle to do that with the Mach-E and the Lightning. And with their next generation stuff that they were working on and now canceled. And they basically essentially started a new company and hired all new people to do it the way that Tesla and the Chinese and other automakers.
You think they'll manage it? Or you think at some point the old Detroit ways will sneak back in?
I think that for the foreseeable, for now they'll be okay. The question is, can they execute on it? I think, what they're, from the conversations I've had with them, the stuff that they're talking about is absolutely on track. They're doing the right things. Can they actually execute on it? We'll see. But the other problem longer term that they haven't really given me an answer on is, we've seen automakers in the past try to essentially start up a new company within the company to do things in a different way. And it's worked. And, I mean, the classic example of that was Saturn.
Okay.
GM started Saturn in the late 1980s as essentially a completely new automaker part that's owned by GM, but was completely separate. And they got to do everything themselves. They built a new factory. They built a new vehicle platform and everything else and set up their own dealerships. And a lot of it worked really well. But what they never figured out was how to then take the lessons from Saturn and incorporate that into the rest of the company. And GM or Ford kind of did that with the Team Edison project that eventually spawned the Mach-E and the Lightning and the E-Transit. But again, they couldn't figure out how to transfer that back into the rest of the Ford. And so now they're doing it all over again. And so I don't know. We'll see what happens.
I'll give you an example, which I just did on the way here. So we had this trial for full self-driving at the Model Y. We were basically using it to drive everywhere. So we wanted to see if we could drive 2,000 miles without. And we managed. It was like 99%, which is pretty good. Mm-hmm. It went away at the end of the month. And this is the first time I drove the Tesla since then. So I'm driving it. And I noticed that, if I kind of veer off into, the shoulder, it corrects. So basically lane departure warning. Mm-hmm. So now all of a sudden I have lane departure warning. Now in every car that I get from every other manufacturer, Sam, I'm not joking, especially Toyota, I can spend 15 minutes trying to find how to turn that off. Sometimes there's a button, and sometimes, it's buried 14 menus into the software. With the Tesla, I found it in like 2 seconds. I went to autopilot, full self-driving, toggle off.
Done. Yeah.
That's simple. And right. This and maybe easy, maybe it's one of these cases where doing software easily is hard.
Oh, it is. It's hard to design a good software interface.
Yeah, but I mean, I found it immediately, turned it off, all was good in the world. And then the other point you made was, I think Tesla was one of the only companies that was allowed to go into China without having a joint venture, a JV.
Yeah.
And I was doing some research on that, and I was listening to some podcasts, and then I kind of stumbled upon I think she was a Chinese correspondent for AP. And she said the reason they did that was that the Chinese government has a saying where if you throw a catfish into a pond with regular fish, all the other fish start to swim faster. And that was the thinking why they allowed Tesla to go into China, because it allowed them to create competition in that space, and all the other Chinese companies started to swim faster, and then of course that created competition and better carcass for the Chinese.
Well, the other thing that, that happened in China is, I don't know if you've read the book Apple in China.
I have not, no.
It's a really interesting book that came out last year.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that they talk about, you know, when Apple started doing manufacturing in China, you know, they worked, you know, they had a partner in Foxconn that set up factories in China. And they hired a lot of Chinese engineers, a lot of Chinese technicians, and people working in the factories. And they had to train those people.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was, you know, because there was some oversight from the government, you know, from time to time, some of those engineers and designers and everything, they would leave the company and they would go work somewhere else. And what ended up happening after a few years is you had this diaspora of people who worked at Apple or worked at Foxconn with Apple, and they started up companies like Huawei and Xiaomi and, you know, all these other companies
in China.
So they
learned from Apple.
They learned from Apple, and they took those lessons and did startups. The same thing happened in the auto industry. You had Chinese people that were working at Tesla, working at some of the other foreign companies in China. And then they would, after two, three, 4 years, they would leave and they would go start up. And that's where you get all these startups like NIO and Li Auto and Xiaopeng and all these others. They learned from Tesla and others, especially particularly from Tesla, but from others as well on the manufacturing side. And that, you know, they've been able to take that and start sprinting forward.
So before, do we have some questions, Cole? Okay, sure, let's answer the questions. Before we get, let's see what we got here. I'll put my glasses on. So Tad P says, never put your life in the hands of something that doesn't have an inherent sense of self-preservation. I say this as someone who has good friends who work in the self-driving car business. What do you say to that?
I agree.
Don't fly an airplane because that's on autopilot half the time.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, the idea of, you know, at the core of, you know, what any kind of automated system should have is it should have safety at its core. That, you know, what you don't want to do is crash. That's got to be rule number one. You know, no matter how you do everything else, you know, your ultimate goal is to not hit anything.
So the second one is from Don, and he says, I feel the door handle is getting ready to chop your fingers off in that Polestar. Do you feel that way?
It's unlike the
Tesla, it doesn't pivot. It pops
yeah,
out.
It just pops straight out, yeah. like the Model S and the Model X did. I haven't had that experience. I was watching a video last week. Jason Tartinsky the Autopian. He was showing it, you know, kind of closing in on his fingers. I've never had that happen to me with a Polestar, but that doesn't mean that, I mean, it's certainly possible. It's one of the problems with these types of door handles.
And then he says, why can't we have normal door handles in electric cars? It only adds complexity. I can't wait for these weird electric cars quirks to go away. And this is exactly what we're talking about. We're in a time when the car companies seem to be oblivious to what their customers want or are not listening to their customers. I remember there's that famous saying, right? Steve Jobs said, you can't give customers what they want because they don't know what they want.
Right.
And I remember...
Well, because customers, are, you know, they're coming from what they know, you know, what they've experienced before. And it's probably apocryphal, but there, you know, there's that classic story of Henry Ford, you know, why don't you ask customers what they want? You know, if you ask customers what they want a faster horse, they went a completely different direction from that. And the same thing, you know, Steve Jobs said is, you know, similar to that.
Okay, maybe I don't want to, like, you know, be too prideful here, but I'll give you three examples of modern technology that I knew that I wanted before I wanted it. So before the iPhone came out, I had these crappy flip phones, and I thought, I just want a phone that has internet connectivity, that can text, that I can check stuff on, you know, like stocks. That I can potentially do live phone calls on FaceTime. I mean, I knew this stuff was possible, and yet I was very frustrated for like 5 years. I went through all these different phones that had none of that, right? They had the crappy texting where you had to know like the numbers. And then Apple comes out with basically a small computer, and I'm like, yeah, that's exactly what I wanted.
Yeah.
Right, number two, I'll give you another example. You know, I struggle with this all of the time. I'm like, internet. Especially, like, the nicer the hotel, I just had this happen to me in Mammoth. The nicer the hotel, the worse the internet. I'm like, why can't we have satellite-based internet? It doesn't seem like that'd be such a difficult thing. And sure enough, you know, Musk comes along and creates SpaceX, right? Mm-hmm. Which does that with Starlink. And then the other thing I thought to myself, why are we dumping rockets into the ocean? Can't these things land themselves? I think most people inherently have these ideas, but they're not in the world of the technology world. So I'm sure that there are experts in there that are thinking of this, but this does not seem like any kind of black magic where you think to yourself, wouldn't it be great if instead of dumping a rocket into the ocean, it could actually land itself?
Yeah.
You know what? I think I wanted these things. I just didn't know how to go about accomplishing them.
And you know, to be fair, for a long time, the engineers didn't know how to accomplish it either.
Right.
You
but know, the idea is it's not brain surgery.
Yeah. I mean, the idea of reusable spacecraft, you know, goes back to the 1960s.
Yeah, sure.
But at the time, they didn't have the technology to do it. They didn't have the computer control systems to do it, the software to do it, or the type of propulsion systems to do it. It got like with NASA in particular, you know, with traditional aerospace, they got stuck in a pattern of, you know, this is what we know works. And, you know, because of the safety issues, we want to make sure, you know, they became very risk averse. And so especially after they had some crashes and explosions, they became much more risk averse. And, you know, to both good and bad, you know, SpaceX was much less risk averse, you know.
Yeah,
and
that's his way.
They're willing to, you know, iterate more, go through more changes.
They're willing to break a lot of eggs.
Blow it up, yeah.
Which one could argue is not good.
Yeah.
Especially if those eggs are humans.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so far they haven't done it, you know, they haven't done that egg breaking with humans, which is part of why NASA just announced, you know, change to the Artemis program. They're pushing back, you know, actually landing people on the moon because SpaceX was supposed to provide the moon lander based on the Starship, and that still hasn't gotten into orbit. So
yeah, it keeps blowing up.
Yeah,
and I think we're doing, you know, tremendous environmental damage every time it does.
Yeah.
So let's go back to cars. I kind of feel like the manufacturers have put themselves really far out on the limb and are in a really dangerous situation. First, and let's go back to our topic. They're not listening to customers. I think from the comments I read on our videos, from, you know, seeing what people are telling me when I meet them in person, everybody hates screens.
Uh-huh.
And yet, you know, with like the Nautilus, they're not just doubling down on screens, they're tripling down on screens. And BMW just did this crazy ass thing where, you know, they made the entire front windshield a screen, basically.
Well, the base of the windshield.
The base of the windshield, yeah. But it feels like they're not listening to what their customers want, and they're putting themselves in a position where it's not going to be hard for somebody to come along and listen to the customers and kind of undercut them on either on price or on what people want. And I think that's the first part of this equation. So our manufacturers aren't listening. Secondly, for some reason, our government has doubled down on old technology because, let's face it, internal combustion is old technology. Uh-huh. There's this famous like YouTube video where the guy says, imagine flip things around backwards, right? Imagine if all cars had been electric.
In the early 20th century, the majority of cars were electric.
But let's say that's what we were living. Let's say that today we're all driving electric cars.
Yeah.
And then somebody comes and invents the internal combustion engine.
Yeah, they think you're nuts. Why would you do this?
Yeah, wait, it pollutes?
It's noisy. It smells.
It could kill me if I leave the garage door closed.
Yeah.
Carbon monoxide.
What,
yeah.
What are you thinking?
Yeah, exactly. And yet our industry and our government has doubled down on this technology. And look, I want to give people choice. I want to give people the ability to choose what they want. But at some point, I can't help but feel that under most circumstances, electricity is a better way to power a car for most people. It's just easier. I mean, just starting with the fact that your house is your gas station. My wife, and I know journalists do this where they go to their wives.
But assuming you could park off street.
Yeah, exactly.
Which, you know, as I was talking about,
apartment dwellers have issues.
You know,
yeah.
Or well, even you know, homeowners in, like I say, in a lot of older cities, like in Denver, you know, you got cars lining the street, but now both sides because you've got these houses that are right next to each other. There's no driveways, so charging an EV in a place like that would be much more complicated.
Yes, granted, but then now we're building out chargers at a pretty astounding rate, and so public charging is becoming much more of a doable thing.
Yeah.
So there's just a lot of pluses that electric cars have. And finally, we were there like, I think, 2 years ago where we were trying to, we bought a Tesla Model S, an old one, to show how much longevity the batteries have. Mm-hmm. That's one of the biggest fears, of course, that people have is that they worry that the batteries, like your phone, are going to go bad after a year or two. But now, basically, the statistics are out and you lose like 1%
per year. Unless you drive an early first generation Nissan Leaf, your battery is going to last 10, 15 years easily and have most of its capacity after that time. And, you know, every new EV has got 100,000-mile warranty on that battery. So if it does, you know, the capacity does drop off, you take it in, they're going to replace it for you, no charge.
And it's funny because I listened to another podcast. I listened to too many podcasts probably, which is this guy in Texas.
There's no such thing as listening to too many podcasts.
All right, fair enough. and he's called the Car Pro, and I feel like he hates electric cars, and so he recommends Toyotas to everybody because for him, value and reliability are the keys. Mm-hmm. But if you want reliability, get yourself an electric car. Seriously, obviously there are issues. You had an issue. We should talk about your issues. Yeah. So what happened with your car? Because it bricked itself, so let's take a step back. They can break. If they go bad, they go bad in a really bad way.
Okay, so my wife and I last year, we bought a Kia EV6, used one, low mileage, and Hyundai Motor Group, so that's Hyundai, Kia, and Genesis, they've had an issue with what's called the integrated charge control unit. It's basically the onboard charger system on those vehicles, and they would unfortunately fail sometimes, and the way it would fail is that it would a fuse would blow, and it would not be able to charge the 12-volt battery because all these cars still have a low-voltage battery to run all the, you know, the lights and the gauges and the computers and
Tesla's
everything else.
Tesla's trying to get away from that.
Yeah, well, I mean, but they still, I mean, they're still doing 48-volt, which is still a low-voltage system. So you still have the separate circuit.
And basically, you don't have, like, high-voltage headlights.
Right. Nobody's got headlights that run at 400 volts or 800 volts. You know, but you know, Ford on their new UEV is doing what Tesla did on the Cybertruck, going to an all 48 volt system. But at any rate, when the ICCU fails, the 12 volt battery won't charge, and then the computers and everything die. And so, back in December, you know, before we bought the car, I checked the recall site, it's a recall site, put in the VIN number and said, hey, you know, does this have any open recalls on it? Said, nope, it's all checked out. As it turned out, for the recall that Hyundai and Kia had on these things, they would first do an inspection, make sure everything was okay.
And they inspected your car?
It had been inspected twice, and no problems.
Until you bought it.
Until a month and a half after we bought it. And then my wife was about two blocks from home. The electric system warning light came on, and she went into turtle mode. She got it to the garage. When I got home, I figured, okay, I'll try and get it to the dealer, which is about a mile and a half away. I got about two blocks, and the 12-volt went completely dead, and I ended up getting it towed to the dealer. They replaced the ICCU, no charge, because it was under warranty. It was a recall. It took 2 days, but we haven't had a problem since. And, you know, they've got a redesigned version of that ICCU, which looks like they're no longer having problems with the updated version of it, but if you have an older one. And to be fair, Hyundai Motor Group is not the only company having problems with 12-volt batteries.
Oh,
Nicole
I was about to say,
with her Jeep Wagoneer S.
Oh, my God. If you guys want to listen to an incredible story, go back to Wheel Bearings and find the episode where Nicole talks about what happened when her car died at the airport, like, for the third time, I think.
I think that was the third time.
And then the tow driver basically smashed it on the little bollards coming out of the airport.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. You could write a book on that. That was incredible.
Nicole no longer owns that car.
No. Because the thing, like, bricked itself multiple times.
Yeah.
But to be fair.
But Ford, even Tesla and Rivian have had problems with the 12 volts dying.
Yes.
So, you know, it's.
To be fair, Stellantis has not had a good record with their EVs.
No.
Including the Jeeps.
Yeah, the plug-in hybrids have had a lot of problems too.
Yeah.
A lot of recalls.
So I could see why people, to be fair, would be very gun-shy about getting one of the Stellantis products.
Yeah. But you know, apart from that, they are generally very reliable.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a whole lot that can break.
A lot fewer moving parts.
Yeah. You don't have to take it in for oil changes. Change your cabin air filter every 12 or 20,000 miles, whatever. You know, wear items like tires and wiper blades and things like that, you'll have to replace, obviously. But the mechanical parts are generally pretty reliable.
Yeah, and of course now we're entering an era with plug-in hybrids where we're carrying around two powertrains. We'll see how that comes out. I'm curious to see if so far the only one, well, the Volt was kind of the first, right? It was a pioneer. And then BMW i3 came along and did it.
ERevs, yeah, extended range EVs.
Yeah, so.
But those, it's funny, you know, those are actually simpler than a plug-in hybrid. You know, so a plug-in hybrid is basically a hybrid with a bigger battery, more powerful motor. And, you know, everybody knows how to make hybrids, make those pretty reliably.
Oh, by the way, I'm just going to jump in here. I figured out something. I was in this podcast. A lot of older people don't understand that you don't have to plug in a plug-in hybrid. And the reason for that, I figured out, is because it's a plug-in hybrid. The two words in the order. People think when you say plug-in hybrid that they have to plug in the hybrid.
Right.
As opposed to, it's the exact opposite. You never have to actually plug it in.
But if you don't, then you're carrying around several hundred pounds of dead weight.
Yeah, which is what most people do.
Yeah, which is unfortunate. You know, if you're not going to plug it in, don't buy a plug-in hybrid.
Yeah.
But, you know, EREVs are mechanically a lot simpler because the engine's just driving a generator. And, you know, so it's an EV with an onboard generator. And so those should actually do better than the plug-in hybrids.
So my supposition here is I think we're living in a very dangerous time for auto industry because they've doubled down on old technology. And right now, of course, with the Trump administration, that seems to be the way to go. But I worry that 2-3 years from now, the pendulum's going to come swinging back very hard the other way.
It might be more like 2-3 months based on what just happened this weekend.
Yeah, yes.
I mean, oil prices spiked up this morning.
That's a good point.
And gas prices could be on the way up in the coming days.
People are predicting $100 a barrel, which could be pretty...
So then you're looking back at, you know, $4 to $5 a gallon gas.
And then you've got this other dynamic. You're going to see a lot of EVs on the market in the next coming months. We actually have one of those ourselves. We leased a Leaf for 2 years.
Which I saw outside.
Yeah. And all those are going to come back now. There's been 300,000 cars, apparently, are coming back this year from off leases. And so there'll be a lot of, I'm guessing, relatively inexpensive and affordable EVs out there.
Yeah, and, you know, that's going to be real interesting to watch because, you know, you're going to have this flood of off-lease EVs that are going to be, you know, relatively cheap, certainly a lot cheaper than they were new.
Yeah.
Let's face it, they've been
expensive.
That's why my wife and I bought a used EV6.
Yeah.
You know, we got an EV6 all-wheel drive wind model with 13,500 miles on it for $27,000, which is half the original sticker price. So you're going to see all these off-lease EVs coming, showing up on used car lots in the second half of this year. And so I think, you know, a lot of people are going to look at those, especially if gas prices are up, and say, hey, that's a really interesting idea. I think I'm going to get one of these. And when they experience and they spend time with them, the vast majority of people that buy an EV, yeah, some people go back to a gas car. But most people, you know, 80 to 90% of people that buy an EV end up sticking with it. And so then the next time that they're shopping for a car, you know, by the time they're in the market for a replacement, there's going to be more affordable EVs in the market. And so I think longer term, that's actually going to help the EV market.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. I think that what's happened is that we could be seeing like a Henry Ford Model T kind of moment where finally there'll be affordable, because people always are. We need affordable EVs, right? Mm-hmm. And the only one that's been affordable is a Bolt, sort of, kind of, and the Leaf, but that had its own issues. But I'll give you an example. So we had a girl here, Mary, who worked here for a year. She was a videographer. She was also on camera. And that was her car to drive. It was a company car. And she didn't have a charger at home. She lived in like a townhome. But she did fine just charging it overnight using. And of course, that EV is a very small battery, so it's 150 miles of range. But for her, driving to Fort Collins, which is a pretty long drive, she was able to either charge it here at work or charge it over at home at night using just a regular plug and make it work. And I think given enough incentive, I think people will find that an affordable EV is really good as a second kind of just around town car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, 80% of daily driving in the United States is less than 40 miles a day.
Yeah, I remember they tried to sell that to us initially. It didn't work.
But, I mean, you know, I think people tend to not believe it until they actually spend time driving an EV and they realize, oh, yeah. Like my wife, she only plugs in the car once or twice a week. And, you know, that's enough. It, you know, we never have to go charge it at a DC charger or anything. We've got a charger at home. Plugs in once or twice a week, and that's sufficient. And once you get used to that, and you realize, oh yeah, I actually can live with this. And that's where I think these cheap used EVs are going to make a difference.
Yeah, and I also think that manufacturers are finally getting the message, and I think we're seeing already a return to buttons.
Uh-huh.
We're seeing a return to regular door handles, or we will be seeing it. So I think it takes a long time for the auto industry to adopt anything.
Well, like Hyundai, a couple of years ago, when they did the refresh on the current Tucson and the Santa Cruz, you know, when those first came out, the current generation, they had this big center screen with all touch controls on there, and everybody hated it. And so 2 years later, they completely redesigned the dashboard and went back to a bunch of buttons and switches and knobs. GM, to their credit, has stuck with that on most of their vehicles. They never did go down that path. Volkswagen on the new ID Polo, you know, that's the first one they're going back to all buttons and switches.
Yeah, well, they really hosed it with their
With the ID4 or ID3.
Yeah, the infotainment was, I think the board member for technology got.
Yeah. A lot of people lost their jobs.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, so I've been kind of bitching and moaning about, these cars are awful. So what I want to do is I want to end this on kind of, let's talk about great cars, the best cars. Give it some thought. I've got a small list in my head, so I'll give you some cars that I think are just knocking out of the ballpark. Okay. And then you give me some cars that you think are. So if you're out there and you're looking for a new car and you want something, and we'll do all kinds of cars at all kinds of different prices. So let me start with, I think, the best car that we've bought recently, and this is a very expensive car. We bought a C8 Z06.
Mm-hmm.
That car, I mean, the whole, I think, Corvette lineup is just incredible. I think that they have basically built a Ferrari with a flat plane crank, and they have done so at a quarter of the cost. And now with the new ZR1 and ZR1X, it's incredible. First of all, the ZR1X, even though it's got internal combustion, is quicker than like the Lucid Sapphire, which is all electric, which is unbelievable because you have instant torque out of the electric motors, but you don't have it out of the Corvette, and yet it's quicker in a straight line, which is unbelievable. And the cars are just really good. I mean, really good. And there's so much choice. And people, They give the Corvette a hard time because obviously a lot of older guys drive them. And for a long time, it has had this kind of like country club, attitude. But man, the new cars are just pure sports cars.
Yeah, no, I agree. In the best sense of the word. You know, the C8 generation Corvette, I mean, for the last several generations, the Corvette has been an amazing value for a high performance car. You know, the level of performance you get compared to, European hypercars and supercars is, it's comparable. And yet they, they cost a fraction of the price. Even the ZR1X is what, about 210, 215?
Yeah, sir, it's about there, yeah.
Yeah, which is half of what you'll pay for a Ferrari or a McLaren or, anything else that gets, less performance than that.
This video that Cole is showing is we gave it to our race car driver, Paul, and mm-hmm. he set the track record by like a second in the Z06.
Yeah. Well, and one thing, the Z06 that was with the Z06. The ZR1X is a hybrid. And so it's actually getting its initial launch pull from the front axle, from that electric motor. So it's getting that instant torque as the V8 is starting to build up its torque. And then it takes over and really keeps that thing going.
Yeah. So I'm really impressed by what GM has done. And GM has this way of being ahead of the curve, sometimes with technology,
sometimes too far ahead of the curve.
Did you know? Here's an interesting story. Did you know that Toyota's Synergy hybrid system was co-developed with GM?
The original concept of that parallel hybrid system, the power split hybrid, was patented in 1969 by TRW.
Yeah, and then GM and Toyota somehow.
But I'm not sure GM was involved with
Toyota with
development of that. The GM was developing their own hybrid stuff.
No, they co-developed it, and then they sold the rights to Toyota. Okay. Then Toyota ran with it.
But when TRW originally invented it, got the patents in 1969, 70, at the time, the technology from an electronics and software standpoint didn't really exist to make it commercially viable. It wasn't until the 1990s that it really became practical.
All right, let me give you two other cars that I think are knocking out of the ballpark. We just had one here as a long-termer, the new Passport,
uh-huh.
Trail Sport.
Yep.
I think, Honda's it's a head-scratcher. So Toyota kills it off-road. And as you know, especially with Farley now, I had this quote where he's like surprised at how popular off-roaders are. The world has gone off-road. And Toyota has this incredible legacy of building off-road motorcycles in their motorsport world, but they never applied it to their cars.
Honda.
Yeah, and they never applied it to the car. So Toyota makes great motorcycles. They make great side-by-sides. And finally, they're starting to get serious about, like, and the Trail Sport Passport is just a really good car in terms of styling. It doesn't have a low range.
Yeah.
Which, you know, for us living in Colorado is kind of bad. But if you're in Michigan, you could live without it.
Yeah. I mean, even Colorado, you know, if you're driving it on the road, you know, if you're not going on the trails, you don't really need the low range. But yeah, it's really, really good. You know, and I think the next generation of that will probably, you know, I suspect that they
Don't love the push button transmission, but.
Yeah. But apart from that, you know, it's a good vehicle. I like the styling. I like the size of it. It's a lot of fun.
And I would say, you know, it competes directly with the 4Runner. Mm-hmm. And the 4Runner kind of owned that market for some reason. Just as the off-roaders were getting hot, Nissan decided to do away with the Xterra.
Yeah.
Of course, they're bringing it back, but it was like if you want to.
Their timing was a little off.
You could do a whole show about, like, really bad decisions.
Yeah.
But, you know, we owned a 4Runner. I would have rather probably had this, because the problem with the 4Runner is, while it's exceptional off-road, you know, there's that diagram where the better it is off-road, the worse it is on-road.
Yeah.
And the 4Runner kind of suffers from that when you get it on-road.
Biased a little too much to off-road.
Yeah, it's a little rough riding. It's a little choppy.
And it depends on what you want to do with it.
Yeah. So that's one. I think if we're in the Honda world, I think the Civic is also just incredible right now. All the different flavors of Civic.
Yeah. The Civic is one of my favorite cars, Yeah, it's really fuel efficient. The hybrid system in the Civic, the Honda hybrid system that they have in the Civic, CR-V, and Accord, is a really good system. It's very efficient, and it's actually way more fun to drive, way more pleasant to drive than Toyota's hybrid system.
Yeah, and the other head scratcher, which is still, I don't know why, but we had the Maverick last year and just loved it. We had the all-wheel drive hybrid. We average 40 mpg all the time. Just such a useful truck. Ford managed to do something the Japanese do really well, which is make it bigger on the inside than the outside. So even somebody like me or Andre, who's actually taller than me, we felt comfortable in the thing. Just a really great truck. And the question I have is, why isn't Toyota or somebody else? I mean, obviously the Santa Cruz is out there, but that's more of a lifestyle truck.
Yeah.
Why isn't anybody else?
You know, Santa Cruz is based on the Tucson, which is available as a plug-in hybrid hybrid. And they never put that system into the Santa Cruz, which I could never really get a good answer from Hyundai on why they didn't offer that.
And I've heard from my contacts that the Toyota was going to launch a Stout, and it was going to be electric. We saw a concept.
And
of
I think it is coming, but it's been pushed back a couple of years.
Yeah,
it's going to be around 2029.
Yeah, now it might be a hybrid, or there might be a hybrid version of it. I've heard.
I wouldn't be surprised, because they've got a new multi-energy platform that they're launching with the new Lexus ES. Which is going to be available as both an EV and a hybrid. So they could use something based on that for the Stout to do hybrid and BEV.
Another Ford product which is outstanding is the Bronco. Mm-hmm. I think they benchmarked the Wrangler and then took it a step above all the stuff. So unlike the Wrangler, and I love the Wrangler, don't get me wrong, but the Wrangler is very much off-road focused, and there's a lot of compromises when you're on-road.
That was a 4Runner.
Yeah. But with the independent suspension, the Bronco was able to make it livable on-road. And I think that's another one. Anyone you want to throw in there that you like?
Yeah, you know, I think a car that is very much underrated, you know, especially, I mean, you know, we've all talked a lot about affordability lately. And, you know, so I think there's a few vehicles out there that are underappreciated. One of those is the Nissan Sentra.
We just had it at the office.
Yeah, you know.
We had the SR.
It's pretty basic, but it's, especially the new one, the latest one, the design of it looks good. The interior is much improved. It drives pretty nice. You know, it's not a sports car, but you know, it gets decent fuel economy. It's roomy enough inside, and you can get it starting at about $23,000-$24,000. So you know, if you're looking for something affordable, that's absolutely something to take a look at. You know, the Civic, big fan of the Civic. Let's see what else. You know, on the EV side, actually, the new Nissan Leaf, I think, is really good.
Yeah, they just did away with the cheap one, though.
Although I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, depending on what happens, you know, with gas prices, that could change. They could shift, and maybe revive that one. I mean, they're still building those overseas. They're just not offering them in the U.S. at the moment. But we'll see what happens there. You know, there's also the Bolt is coming back now.
Zach is actually in L.A. I think they're going to do a first look at it.
Oh, are they?
Yeah, okay. Tomorrow, yeah. I think, yeah.
I know there's one in the, there's at least one in the Detroit press fleet, because when I had a car being delivered earlier this week, they came in a Bolt to pick up the car that.
How about I'll ask you this question in a second, but I think Nissan is actually turning it around. I think it's not just the Sentra. I think actually the Pathfinder is okay, and they're now going to do an Xterra, which is great. Finally, too late.
And there's an all new Rogue. Coming this fall, which is going to, we've seen what it looks like. Nice design. It's going to have that e-power, that third generation e-power drivetrain in there. So they'll have something to compete against the hybrids from Toyota and Honda and Hyundai. So I think there's a lot of interesting stuff. In the three row utilities, the new Hyundai Palisade, and next week going to be driving the Telluride, the Kia Telluride. Those have a really interesting new hybrid system on there, so you get better performance, better fuel economy. So I think there's a lot of interesting stuff out there.
I'll give you cars that have also surprised me that I wasn't expecting. The Blazer, it had a really hard birthing. I mean,
the EV?
Yeah. The stop sale did not help, but actually the EV Blazer, it's also the wrong name. For God's sakes, Jim, build a V8-powered Blazer, just do what Ford did with the Bronco. Why would you slap that nameplate?
Yeah.
But the EV is actually really good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's surprising. Yeah.
No, it's good. Well, and, on the same platform, there's also the Equinox.
Yep.
Which has nearly as much room inside. It's a surprisingly roomy vehicle. And you've got over 300 miles of range, almost 320 miles of range in the base version. And it's you can get it starting at like $37,000.
And the other one that I think is a smash hit out of the ballpark is probably the Land Cruiser. I think what Toyota did.
Yeah.
And you never see a car company actually make a car cheaper, because the 200 series, I know it's a 250, it's not a 300, I get that, but it doesn't matter, right? Everybody's like, it's a Prado, and then, it's a 2. And I'm like, it doesn't matter, it's here in America, they can call it whatever they want.
Yeah.
Obviously, Chevy called the Blazer, an electric car, so they could do what they want, but the new Land Cruiser is actually really good, and we just were with Toyota in California, and we got to drive all of their off-roaders. And I really fell in love with the GX as well.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, I think the GX is actually kind of the sweet spot there, because what I found, when I had the Land Cruiser, the one I had, was the mid-level, it was a Heritage Edition, and it was like $72,000, $73,000, which was bumping up on the price of the GX. And the GX has that 3.4 liter twin turbo V6. And the, for that $70,000+ price point, the interior of the Land Cruiser felt a little cheap, whereas the GX, feels a lot more premium for not much more money. And I think if I was spending that kind of money, I would probably go with the GX over the Land Cruiser.
Yeah. So we just put. How do you handle this? So we just put out a video where me and Tommy did a first dirt on the new GX 2026. Mm-hmm. And there was a guy in the comments who said, "Oh, you guys, are paid and bought for by Toyota because you didn't mention the fact that those engines are failing." And I'm like, first of all, we mentioned it, on our truck.
Ad infinitum.
Yeah. And at some point, this has been going on for 2 years. I suspect that the hybrids also have that issue because it's the same engine.
Mm-hmm.
But Toyota is slow. First, they did 100,000. They did another 100,000. And that Toyota is slowly rolling out, those recalls, because it's a lot of engines to recall.
Yeah.
And so the hybrids, until they do, I don't know what's going on
inside the company. Toyota... they're going to take care of their customers. Most of them are not failing. Yes, a significant number are failing, but most are not. And if and when yours does fail, or if the recall gets to you before it fails, Toyota's going to give you a brand new engine. They're going to fix whatever is wrong with it, and they're going to give you a brand new engine.
Which is a lot of, it's a B, billions.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to cost them several billion dollars to replace.
So I can't go all Scotty Kilmer on them.
Yeah.
Because, here's the thing, guys. And I'm sure you run into this yourself, right? I could do three videos when I'm doing one of these, right? Mm-hmm. I could do the video here. The video I was taught to do as an old school journalist. Here are the top five things I love and hate about this car. No one's going to watch that because the haters want to hate and the lovers want to love. The next one that's going to be the most popular is, here are the top five things I love about the car. That's the preaching to the choir. And then the one that's going to get the most views is, you know, here are the top five things I hate about it. And that unfortunately is the way of the world right now. But as an old school journalist, we try to be fair, and I can't be like every video like, oh, by the way, did you know that, you know, Toyota is recalling 200,000 of these engines?
Yeah.
Or Lexus in this case.
But I mean, you know, look at every automaker. You know, they're all having
look
problems.
Look at Ford, yeah.
GM's recalling the 6.2-liter V8s. Ford's recalling everything for everything.
And let's end on that. Why do you think that is? Why do you think there's so many? I think it's new technology. We're really pushing the bounds of either hybrids.
Yeah,
or
but they're, I mean, like with Ford, there's a lot of stuff that they're replacing. You know, that they're having to do recalls on. That's not new technology. Like cracking fuel injectors.
Yeah,
that's not new technology. I don't know. I honestly don't know what the root cause is. You know, and Ford is having so many problems across so many areas with their vehicles that, you know, I think that there's something more fundamental going on in their organization there.
They lost job one?
Yeah.
I mean, look, they used to have a V10 that used to pop out its spark plugs. So maybe they've made progress since then.
Well, I mean, you know, you and I are both old enough to remember what Ford used to stand for.
Yes, I know.
Fix or repair daily.
Yeah. Look, one of the things that BYD does, and we're back to the Chinese, is they're completely integrated, which is incredible, right? Mm-hmm. Even the boats that they ship their cars on are owned by BYD. And I think
same thing with Hyundai.
Yeah, and Tesla's doing a similar thing as well. And I think if you have the less suppliers you have, you probably end up with less recalls because you control the process. And the traditional Detroit 3 have a lot of suppliers. Mm-hmm. And so I think there is some tension there where you're trying to create very reliable cars at the same time trying to make them cheap as possible.
Well, and this is one of the things with the again, going back to the Ford Skunkworks UEV program. Is, you know, they deliberately tried to go much more vertically integrated with that. So they're building their own batteries. They're building, you know, more and more of the stuff. They're doing their own electronic architecture, their own software. And so there's a much higher degree of vertical integration than you find in any other Ford products. So it's going to be interesting to see, again, how well they can execute on that.
So do you foresee a future of Chinese electric cars running around not just Canada?
Absolutely.
But America.
Oh, yeah, it's going to happen.
Yeah, I think so. I think so, too.
I think the first ones we're going to see are going to be, you know, from the Geely group. Yeah, Zeekr is part of Geely, as is Polestar and Volvo.
Polestars are Chinese cars, basically.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they were designed in China. Well, a lot of it was designed in China and Sweden.
Well, I got it.
But they're originally built in China. The ones we're getting are coming from South Korea. But Volvo has a vastly underutilized factory in Charleston, South Carolina. And so I think that probably within the next 24 months, we will see Zeekers or other Geely Group vehicles coming out of that factory.
Yeah, for sure. And then it's like people don't know this, but the BMW has, I think, 11 factories. The biggest one is in Spartanburg.
Yeah.
And it builds basically all of their crossover/SUVs.
That factory exports more vehicles from the United States than basically the rest of the industry combined. Because they build the X5, the X6, the X7, I think the X4s, build some
SUVs,
of the X3s.
Most of them. Yeah.
And so they, you know, but most of the, like the X5, X6, X7 are exclusively built there. They're not built anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of those get exported to Europe, to Asia, to South America, the Middle East.
Yeah. And, you know, I could also foresee a future where if you're one of the Chinese companies, Chrysler has one car. You just saw the new version of the Pacifica. You know, these companies are.
They promise we'll have more soon.
Yeah, I was listening to another podcast, and they I think they asked a question: how many brands does Stellantis own? How many brands do you think Stellantis owns? And can you name all of them?
14, I think
14 or 15. Yeah,
yeah.
They could shed a few, and then that could become a Chinese car.
Yeah, so I mean,
car.
You know, you got Ram, Jeep, Chrysler, and.
Ram, Jeep, Chrysler. Yeah, that's three.
And Dodge in North America.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you got Alfa Romeo, Fiat, Peugeot, Citroen, DS, Lancia, Opel, Vauxhall.
That's 12. You're very good, Sam. That's incredible.
Let's see. There's
two more.
There's a couple more.
I'm surprised you got DS. Right, that's a hard one.
Yeah.
Did you say Lancia?
Right, I did say Lancia.
Yeah, people forget that one.
Yeah. Well,
you said Fiat, right?
I said Fiat.
You said Alfa. Anyway.
Oh, Maserati.
Maserati, yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, I finally got the MC McPura.
Yeah.
And I
haven't driven that one yet. I drove the MC20 about a year and a half ago.
Yeah. I remember I was jealous.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were
very much
about
enjoyed
it.
That car.
I would have enjoyed it, except I parked it. I came in late to Florida. I picked up in Florida. I parked it next to the basketball court, unbeknownst to me, and some young girl was playing basketball and dropped the basketball right on the driver's side windscreen,
oh,
and it completely spidered.
Oh.
Not like a rock. I mean, like, you know, like, yeah. like I was driving it, like looking out the passenger side.
Oh,
so I had a horrible week with it, and I got into so much trouble with my wife because it has no luggage room. And I said, "Honey, we're gonna get this really cool car. I don't think your luggage is gonna fit." She had just a rollerboard.
Yeah.
And she's like, "Well, I need to bring."
Yeah. I remember you talking about her.
Yeah.
Had to hold it in her lap.
Oh my God, she was so angry at me. Oh, that was such a sometimes.
That's why when I travel with my wife and get a press car, I always try to make sure I get something suitable.
Yeah, Polestar 4.
Yeah.
All right. Well, guys, thanks for joining us. Please go check out Wheel Bearings. It's a really fun podcast. These guys have a great time talking about every car that they've been driving. And they
and Sticky Kids and then fridge cigarettes.
The one topic that you guys are bringing to the forefront is, of course, how much those delivery charges have changed.
Oh yeah,
that's like
and now suddenly everybody's writing about it.
Yeah, you guys were the first.
Yeah,
how they snuck in the tariff cost by especially the big three GM. I think Stellantis is like $2,500 now.
All three of them now on the full size trucks and utilities they're $2,595, so $2,600.
And that's not negotiable.
Yeah,
yeah. I like when companies just increase the price and keep the delivery. And it's the Japanese do that, right? Even if it's coming from Japan.
Yeah, well, I mean, Toyota's actually held the line on the Tundra and Sequoia. They're still only $2,095, so $2,100. But you know, what's funny, you know, when you look at
Texas,
when you look at more expensive
Mexico.
European cars,
yeah.
Especially, you know, they don't bother trying to hide it.
You know,
they just increase the MSRP. So you get BMWs from Germany, you know, $995 for delivery charge.
Yeah, yeah, a bargain.
Yeah. Whereas an F-150 that's coming from a plant 20 miles from my house, $2,600.
Yeah, I know. You're being sneaky, Ford. Stop it. Knock it off. All right, guys. Thanks for watching. Head on over to alltfl.com for news, views, and real-world reviews. Sam, thanks, man. Really
appreciate
it. That was a lot of fun. We'll see you guys next time. Ciao.
All right.